Hello everyone, Chris Oakley here, and you're listening to the Kit List Podcast Extra. Once again, we're here to provide you with more football kit chat in a special bonus podcast that's immediately free to download. Joining me today are the K Crew, the Kit Collective, the Shirt Squad. Call them what you will, but individually, let me introduce Rich Johnson. Hello, Rich.
Hello, the K Crew. Sounds like a breakfast cereal thing from the 80s.
Secondly, we have John Devlin. Hello, John.
Hello, Chris. Hi. I'm thinking K Crew is a bit more like Blazing Squad. Could we not be the Kit Blazing Squad or something like that?
No.
Okay.
Oh, well, we have one thumbs down, I think, already on that one. I'll think about that. Come back to that. And last but not least, from designfootball.com, we have Jay. Hello, Jay.
Hello. I think the Kit Podcast Blazing Crew, I think that's already been taken by one of our rivals. So,
has it? I think I know who you mean.
Who were the ones that did 21 seconds to go? Who was that?
That's So Solid Crew. We're actually conflating them, aren't we? Because it's Blazing Squad, isn't it, I think?
It is Blazing Squad, yeah. Mm. No one said Blazing Crew, though.
Oh, I did, I think.
Say Blazing Squad. Did I say Blazing Crew? I'm just thinking if we were So Solid Crew, then one of us has got to go to prison or something and shoot someone.
Several candidates.
Might compromise and go for So Squalid Crew. Ah, dear. Well, anyway, hello to you all, and hello, listeners. Now then, with Rich having recently launched his new book, The A to Z of Weird and Wonderful Football Shirts, we thought we'd record a podcast to find out more about it from the man himself. And indeed we will, once I've received my copy. Because of the current coronavirus situation, postal deliveries have been somewhat disrupted to my part of the world. But fear not, once I've received Rich's new book and had a chance to read it, you can be sure we'll be reconvening to record a podcast all about it. In the meantime, we thought we'd whet your appetite by talking about another book that's been written by a member of the Kit List podcast team, one that many of you, I'm sure, already own. True Colours International Football Kits, written by John Devlin, was published in 2018 and was warmly appreciated by readers all over the world. Back at the time of its release, I decided to record a special one-on-one interview with John to discuss his book, but alas, we were beset with technical issues that rendered the recording unusable. 2 weeks later, we tried again, but this time we were beset with a different set of technical issues, and again, we had no recording to show for all of our efforts. In the end, we conceded defeat in our attempt to promote John's book, but 2 years down the line, we thought we'd try again, and here we are to do just that. So,
And we've had nothing but technical issues.
I'm beginning to think this is jinxed.
It's the True Colours curse.
The curse of True Colours. Anyway, to find out all about True Colours 3, as it's affectionately known, and to begin with, John, perhaps we should provide a bit of context to tell people all about how the book came about. As many people will know, you published two books, True Colours in 2005, True Colours 2 in 2006. What was it that led you to write and illustrate those two books back then, and what was the reaction to them when they were published?
Well, I mean, forgive me if I'm telling you stuff you already know, but I was always worried that I'm going to waffle on and just say stuff that everyone's heard. But yeah, the first two books, which it was really my kind of idea from being a little boy, wanting to see books on football shirts and couldn't understand why none existed. And I learned software when I was at art college doing my graphic design degree, and decided to resurrect my love of football kits as a way of learning software. And then I realised that I now had the tools to actually produce a book that was of sufficient quality to actually do the subject justice. So that's when it all went. It carried on from there. And I sat down, and I was working in the design agency, and I just approached some publishers from an A to Z book, picking them out 10 at a time or 12 at a time, sending them a little brochure explaining what I'm trying to do, selling the concept. And ANC Black, who obviously were in one of the first A to Zs, came back and said, "We love it. Let's go for it." So that's how that started. Mm-hmm. And I think it was 2 years after they first agreed, the book came out, and it was, you know, a dream come true.
Absolutely. Jay, Rich, do you remember getting True Colours, the original True Colours?
I remember it coming out, and I remember, I've said this before on there, I think when we cover this on the Football Attic, I remember going into Borders, the bookshop, and sitting there reading it for ages but not buying it.
One of those sort of people, are you?
I was, unfortunately. But then, yes, I did buy it years later. Well, I bought it after the second one came out, because then it came out in a little sort of box set. And I like that. So I've got the box that goes with it. So that's my preferred choice of book buying, is with a box around it. Yeah. But yes, I do remember it coming out. And for me, it was kind of like, I mean, I'd always loved kits as well since I was a kid. And I think probably like most of us here, it had sort of designed kits, you know, with felt tips and pens and stuff. and I remember when I saw it, I was just like, oh my God, you know, obviously not enough to buy it. But you know, I was quite amazed by it, because not only was it a book about football kits, but it was a perfectly illustrated book. And it's like, it was just like, it was like manna from heaven, but again, not enough to buy it. I was going to spend my own money on it. But yeah, so I do very much remember it coming out and just thinking, wow, you know, but not enough to buy it.
Yeah, okay. I think I was like late to the party in terms of actually owning it, but I had it, I was using it a lot for various reasons, and because other people had it for various reasons. So I don't know when I actually got them. I know I got them together, but I definitely didn't get the box. I had the Chronicles of Narnia in a box, but I didn't get True Colors in a box. But the, yeah, I mean, it's fantastic, and that's the key point, that it wasn't necessarily a new thing to graphically represent colors. So like, that you would have it at the beginning of a season, maybe there would be a graphical representation of the teams in the old First Division, but it wouldn't have like the sponsor, certainly not in the right font and all these kind of things, and the crest wouldn't be properly detailed, and there's obviously a texture to the design as well that you see in all of them, that slight crease effect. So all of that was fantastic. It's not a photograph, and it's not meant to be a photograph, but it is like a very satisfying representation, and that was the first thing that I really remember that actually did it that way. There are websites and things that do representations as well, but this was, yeah, because it was uniform as well, it was very, very satisfying. So every single kit, once you see one kit as done in this way, you can then it's like the relationship between two of John's renderings is the same as the relationship with two shirts in real life. So they're from the same stable, as it were, like that. So that's yeah, great. Just great books.
Sort of consistency of style, if I can even say it.
Yeah.
Thank you, Jay. Well, that was, I mean, I'm really pleased you said that, Jay. Thank you. Because that was a big concern for me. And because you look at research material and you realise that at some point you've got, say, a well-known kit and it's all splashed over the pages of Shoot magazine and you can see it in great colour. But then you've got a third kit that was worn once on a Tuesday night at Hereford, and it's a tiny little black and white picture. That would be no good for publication. So there were two attempts. One was to keep everything the same so people could see what all these kits were like and treat them all equally. That was the important thing as well, is realise that actually, you know, everything, every one of these kits deserves some kind of interest, and raising that subject to actually convincing people that it was a subject worth reading about and worth documenting. But yeah, so that was the idea kind of behind that, and to give everyone the same prominence.
Yeah, I must admit, that's also, I just want to say, that's also an excellent point you made there, Jay, because, and you mentioned Shoot magazine there, John, because, you know, you would, in a lot of cases, see in magazines and things illustrations of kits. But I don't know if it's my imagination playing tricks on me, but often they seem to be kind of hand-drawn, which is fine. But because they were hand-drawn, they had slight differences from one kit to the next. And also sometimes you got the impression that the person that had drawn them maybe didn't know the real detail of the kit. They were just drawing a generalised version of the kit. I mean, I can remember, I know we mentioned this before, John, the Observer's Book of Soccer. Is it soccer, was it called? Or Association Football, whatever it was called. Little pocket book that was out back in the 70s. And the first version of that had little colour illustrations, colour plates. And again, they were great, fantastic. But stuff like that often had a slightly rough round the edges kind of look.
Yeah.
And going back to what Jay sort of said, with what you drew, obviously with the aid of a computer, you had that nice neatness and crispness about each one, and obviously you had an eye for the detail of the kit, what was important, and the you know, the where the badge was situated on the shirt and the sponsor logo size and all of that. So all of that just came together to make it a much better end product, I think.
Well, I think when I was at college and kind of putting this forward as part of my final degree project, the idea was to illustrate identity and to show how identity and branding and colour can be used. And football kits were an ideal way because you had several multi-billion, million-pound industries competing for space on the same bit of material, if you like. So it was all, and then you look at the identity of the people wearing it, and hence the name True Colours. You know, fans trying to make their own identity within the clubs, with sponsors, with manufacturers. So I try to understand the depth that kind of goes behind it as well. But when I approached the publishers, one of the key things was to say that the audiences today, it needs to be sophisticated enough for them to grab it. Because I think when I was excited. In the final stages, I think a year before I was working on the book flat out, the year before it came out, Bob Bickerton's Club Colours came out, which I believe we've all got, or a few of us have got.
And yeah, I
thought, oh no, my idea's gone. But when I looked at it, I realised, and this is no disrespect to him at all, It was the same kind of style you talked about, Chris. That kind of 70s, hand-drawn, no logos. And I thought, no, people, we need to know the logos. Logos are everywhere. That needs to be documented as well. What impact Sharp, JVC, Hitachi have had on the football kit, football shirt kind of culture.
I was going to say that that was one of the things for me that I liked about True Colours, is the fact that it had all the logos and everything. I've always been a big stickler with replica kits, of wanting the kit that's as close to what the players are wearing. So when I was a kid, you know, and half the sort of teams didn't have sponsors on, it used to really bug me, you know. And I remember when the Cov 87 to 89 kit, the Hummel one, came out, the first batch that came out didn't have sponsors on. And I was really annoyed. I was like, oh, seriously? And then the second batch had Granada Bingo on it. You know, crappy sponsor, but I had to have that shirt, you know, so I waited to buy it. And that's the thing. It's like, again, like John says, if you're going to illustrate football kits, you want the kit. You don't just want a representation of a shirt. You want to see the actual kit, and you want to see the details of it. And that's what I always loved about True Colours, was it was the details that you got, like, you know, like the shadow prints and stuff and things like that, and you know, the kind of the sort of subtle trim things. It was all in the detail, and the fact that it had that consistent look meant that you noticed the details more, because you were comparing. Because the template was the same, if you see what I mean, you're the only thing that then stands out is the design of the shirt, rather than sort of the shape of the shirt or anything else. So you get to see just all the sort of the details really well.
No,
I just ran out of words with that sentence there. I was thinking, what's happening to my voice? My brain is not working. I apologise, John. It's a good book. I like pictures. It's got pictures in book. Pictures of kits. I like kits as well. Oh, pictures of kits.
I was just going to say, John, I mean, you must have had lots of sort of feedback after the first two books came out about when Volume 3 was going to come out. Was there likely to be like a third volume in the years immediately after the second book? Was there a third one lined up? Because obviously there was a gap after the second one.
Well, the biggest problem with all of this, and anyone who regularly listens to the Kit Bliss podcast will know, it's clearances, it's copyright permissions. So not only from the club, but from every sponsor and from every manufacturer. So that's what took 2 years, was clearing all of that. So I had to phone and address every single sponsor and say, can I reproduce your logo? And then I realised that's why no one's ever done a book on this, because this is just such bloody hard work. So the first book did really well. The second book didn't do quite so well, because arguably all the bigger clubs are in the first book, because everyone, like it or not, most mass market football people, it's all about Premier League, isn't it? I mean, whether I agree with that is irrelevant. That's what it is. So the second book wasn't such a big seller, but it obviously sold enough. And ANC Black came down to see me at my sort of design office, and they wanted to go ahead with an international book. So that was probably the year after, or 2 years after Two Colors 2 came out. And they had a whole proposal and everything. But, and this is, I guess when I look back on it, I think I made the right choice then. I said, I don't think I can do it justice at this stage, because the international kit world is vastly different to domestic. And to get the research material, the copyright permissions, all of that stuff, I thought, if I can't do it the best way that I can, I'm not going to. I don't want to put something out there that's half-assed and incomplete, and I know deep down I've not done my best on it. So I said, I've got to decline it, and because I just didn't think it was possible at that time. But I did look into it, and I did some work on, I think, Portugal. I picked a team kind of fairly randomly and said, right, let's see how many kits of theirs I can find. And of course, you go back to those days, and before my first book came out, the research material online was virtually nil. It was so hard to find kit documentation and photography. Nowadays, it's totally different. But at the time, it was all virtually from my archives and really delving into the internet, buying stacks of programs. And of course, trying to find out what Mexico wore in 1974 at that stage just was a no-go.
Couldn't do it, yeah.
So that was it. And then we never did anything more. It kind of died right down, and I was doing other kit things at that point.
And then fast forward, of course, to when the third book came around. Having committed to then writing international football kits, which was launched, as we say, a couple of years ago, what was the first step? Did you sort of basically have to sort of make a list of which teams you wanted to feature? Did you get sort of a publisher sort of saying to you, look, we want a book like this with these teams in it? Did you sort of spend a lot of time sort of stroking your chin and thinking, can I do this or should I do it? Or what was the first step?
I think, well, really what happened was the offer came from out of the blue. ANC Black, I don't think, were existing as an imprint anymore, but their parent company were Bloomsbury, who, famous for Harry Potter books, is their biggest, obviously their world famous thing. And a guy contacted me out of the blue and said, I've always loved your books. Would you be up for coming up and having a chat about maybe doing some more stuff? And of course, you think, wow, fantastic. Because at this point, I was running my own design agency, still doing football kit bits here and there. But I never dreamed there'd be another book coming out. So, of course, I jumped at the chance. And he said, right, we want to do an interview. We talked. We got loads of books out. We were up in a cafe in Bloomsbury area, loads of books out, looking at all different ways we could do it. And he said then, I think the first thing I want to try and do is an international book in time for the World Cup, of course, which at that point was maybe a year and a half away. And I just thought, oh my God, I can't do it. It can't be done. But of course, I'm never one for saying no. That's always been my trouble. I always just say yes and agreed to it, and then just started to see how feasible it was. And of course, the internet, the interest around football kits had just exploded in recent years, and I realised that it could be doable. So between us, we agreed the deal and started looking at what teams to feature. And that's how we came up with the list of 20 teams that we have in the final book.
Indeed. I was just going to say, were there any teams, obviously we sort of mentioned earlier on, like with Portugal, way back, going back sort of several years, but when it came to actually do the preparation for the book leading up to 2018, were there any particular teams that were difficult to research at that point? Were there somewhere you sort of thought, oh, I'm not sure we should have included them, it's just turning out to be a bit of a minefield? Were there any that you maybe thought, maybe I shouldn't have picked them?
Well, I think obviously we went for all the big teams. I wanted the home nations and Ireland in there as well. I thought that was really important to acknowledge them. But also, with a commercial hat on, Bloomsbury were keen to include countries that they felt they could sell the book to outside. So various nations like USA were in there, of course the South American teams, but they were the hardest ones. USA, because of their, what would you call it, I guess, inconsistent existence over the years. You know, at times they didn't have a national team in the early 70s, and actually trying to find out what they were wearing. But also the South American teams, the teams like Uruguay and Mexico, Midland, Central America, because there just wasn't the research material there. And also you realise that their culture meant that their kit deals weren't as straightforward as we would have in Europe. So they would wear different kits nearly every game sometimes, and chop and change manufacturers. There was no, it all felt a very different world. So they were the hardest ones, and Russia are another great example because of pure inconsistency. They almost wore whatever they had lying around. It was that kind of vibe in the 70s. And you start to realise, crikey, this is going to be a hell of a job documenting this. So it was, it was quite a worry, I must admit.
And Jay, Richard, I mean, I was just sort of thinking, really, when the book came out, the first thing that sort of struck me about it was obviously its national team kits, which was just so great to see. What was your sort of thoughts when you sort of saw that John's book was going to feature sort of national team kits? Were you in any way sort of thinking, oh, would like to have seen a few more kind of, you know, lower league teams in the UK? Or were you sort of thinking, at last, a book of national team kits in?
The latter.
I would agree with Jay on that one.
Yeah.
Because the reason I say that is because there's been, a few people down the years who have sort of said, John, are you thinking of doing any more with, you know, just randomly picking here, Scunthorpes and Northampton Towns in, and so there must be there must still be a small amount of people that are still asking for that. But I mean, yeah, it sounds like my opinion tallies with both of you in terms of being so pleased to see national team kits featured.
Well, the website exists anyway, so there's been so much more content that's come from John in the intervening period anyway. I'd say probably particularly in terms of club teams. So to get a lot of the international teams in a book like that was just great. And there is something special about international kits. It's not necessarily a preference thing, but it is definitely something new. Rather than expanding on something that's gone before, they're their own beast in a way, international kits. And there's so much, especially when a World Cup's coming up, that you are looking forward to the releases for that. That they are like prestige releases for a lot of the manufacturers. So to have them all compiled in a book was just fantastic, particularly one that's geared towards the World Cup. A lot of the kits that you're going to see all the extra kits as well, which is fantastic, but you're also going to be reminded of all the great World Cup kits. So that was the most exciting thing. Obviously, we had an idea of that it was coming out well before it actually did, but when it actually did, it was great, and it was something completely new. We do call it True Colours 3, and I think that's right that we call it that, but it is separate. The other two are do sort of dovetail with each other, and this one is its own separate entity, and it's great for that, I think.
Well, when I went
for me,
I was just
going to say, like, one of the things I really liked about True Colours 2 was the fact that it had some of the international kits in, obviously the home nations, and I really liked that because I'd always wanted to see like the England kits and the Scotland kits and everything else sort of done in the True Colours style. So, and again, I think I'd said to John before, like, you know, I always wanted to see an international version because I wanted to see Argentina's kits done in the same style and all those. I like a lot of the national teams. It's quite funny, quite a few football fans I know just don't give a toss about the national game and, you know, in terms of, like, England playing or sort of, you know, World Cups and that. They're entirely focused on their clubs, you know. I know quite a few people who are just, like, literally they don't give a toss when England play. It's all about the club for them. But for me, it was just like, I've always been a massive fan of international tournaments and things like that. And I think the other thing was, it wasn't just a case of seeing the kits in illustrated form. I think it was because of the research that John does, it was finding all those ones that you just had never seen before. Because it's like, you know, when you do research on kits, you find all these little things, and it's like you do your little sort of, you have your little self-interest. Like, I knew a lot about the Argentina shirts because obviously that's kind of one of my, you know, big things. So I knew there was lots of subtleties, but obviously for all the rest of them, it's like, I had no idea. So that's one of the things I was looking forward to, is finding all these little gems of kits that you've never seen before. Like, two that I can think of off the top of my head is the Russia one that's, I think they wore it for like one game. It's like the one with the sort of granddad collar style on it. I never even knew that existed. And the other one, I think, was the Mexico one with the sort of crazy pattern on the sleeve. And the one they had at, was it the 98 one, but the reverse, like the away colour or the third or whatever, which is like a sort of green and red and all these kits that you just didn't know existed. It's just great to see them because, and like I say, because you know that John is going to do all that research and it will be thorough. It's like that's for me is like one of the gems is finding all those obscure kits and not only that, but getting the background on them as well, and also finding out about certain kits that you know kind of people think did exist but didn't. I mean, for instance, that the classic one is the. I mean, I've talked about it. In my book, about the two Argentina ones, but the one that I can think of off the top of my head is the Russia one. That's kind of like, kind of like a rag roll paint effect, and it's like, but it never existed. They never wore it, but it was produced as replicas. One of those weird scenarios, I guess, where they've produced all the replicas and then gone to the team, and the team have just gone, "We're not having that." And so they've got all these replicas, and it never happens. It's just so yeah, things like that, all the little subtleties as well. Yeah,
but it's funny you mentioned Russia. That was one of the things that leapt out at me, that they in their Reebok years from 1993 to 96. So that's 3 years. They wore 14 different kits. So at that point, when you're thinking kit deals were more stable and consistent, they were still picking out anything almost randomly what they could wear. But that was the tricky bit was seeing the different cultures, and you start to get a feel for the culture of the country as well, and the Football Federation, how they go about kind of doing their business. But you mentioned the Russia replica. That seemed to be quite common. I mean, for example, if you look on the brilliant old football shirts or, you know, even not so much classic football shirts, but several of these websites, there's stacks of Dutch replica shirts from the 80s. Half of them were never worn. So whether they were supporters' jerseys or knockoffs or just kind of, I don't know, leisure shirts.
Commemorative sort of.
It was whittling those down. And I've tried, there's a couple there. And we mentioned earlier the Dutch blue version of their classic 88 kit. And I've tried to imply, not sure how correct this is, but it's there and it's feasible, but... You know, did it ever get worn? Portugal is another example. If you look at their early 80s period, they had stacks of shirts that you can see wonderful photos of that didn't actually make it to a pitch. So you have to make... I had to make decisions as to how to include these without turning it into a real anorak's guide, but trying to make it entertaining and trying to acknowledge all these unusual variants that were floating around.
Yeah,
It's like the I was going to say that it's like the USA 88 one, which is the Holland 88 style, but weirdly done upside down, and it's like it definitely exists, but can you find any actual pictures of the team ever wearing it? It's like that. I've not found any, and I don't. Did you ever manage to find one at all, John? Of it?
No,
I don't think so. Because I remember you saying about it at the time, and I was like, scouring the internet. I was like, I'm sure I've seen a picture of it. And the only time I'd ever seen a reference to it was a website covering the USA shirts. But even then, I was convinced there was a picture of the team wearing it. But when I went back, there wasn't. And it was just like, oh, crap.
And then again, you've got to consider, in those days as well, teams didn't chop and change to away shirts. So they played far fewer internationals. And if they didn't play a team that wore a clash of colours, they didn't wear the away kit. And there's several instances of that where you know that they would have had that hanging up, ready to go, should it be called for, but it never was. And that's something else that you've got to acknowledge.
Yeah. The that bit's a bonus for me because I got the book thinking that I was going to sort of reminisce about all these kits I knew and go, I would see them and say, oh, I'd forgotten about that one. But yeah, that one's great. I remember that now. But it definitely wasn't. That's just arrogance, because when I went through it, I realised, no, there's so many kits that I didn't know existed, as Rich says. And it wasn't something I prepared for. It wasn't the reason why I bought the book or anything like that, but it was like a pleasant surprise at the end. When you say about making a call about whether something gets into the book or not, what was the rule? Did you have like the equivalent of a style guide, I suppose, for consistency there? Did you, or was it on a case-by-case basis?
One of the basic ones was, I think, I'm trying to think back now, and this goes back to doing my first book, it's whether there were enough differences to warrant an inclusion. So if there was, I think it was three, if there were three key differences, then it would be included as a separate one. And that could be the manufacturer's logo, the badge changed, a bit of trim changed, because we all know how kits, what's the word, vary slightly. It's like Chinese whispers. They alter sometimes in their lifespan. And it would, wouldn't it be lovely to do every single variation? But as Bloomsbury said, it would call for a book that's that thick, that's 9 inches thick. We can't market that. We can't sell that.
That's not 9 inches, John.
Well, whatever.
I'm not going to do the line anyway.
So it's a really good question, Jack. And it, I must admit, that kept me awake, apart from the deadline that was ridiculously short. That's what kept me awake most at night. Do I include that kit because the cuffs aren't on it on that version, but they are on this one? So I was very, I had to have a style guide. I had to have a rule book that determined whether it went in or not.
I remember that for the Argentina kits, because obviously, like I say, I'd done quite a bit of research on those before you were doing this, and it's like, I remember sort of saying, oh yeah, and then for this match, they sort of changed, and they had like thinner stripes on this one, and then that match, they did this, and it was like, and then for the Olympics, they had a sort of similar thing like this, and you were just like, one, I'm not including the Olympics, and then two, it was secondly, and like you said, John, it was like, if you include every single one that they actually wore, it's like, it just becomes ridiculous. It's like, did you have any criteria as well as if they'd only worn it for one match, but it wasn't a significant match? Like, so you got a lot of like, you know, random friendlies, and also things like friendlies against clubs in sort of warm up matches for tournaments. It's, I think some of the Argentina ones are in there, because they were sort of designated kind of, I don't know, like third shirts or something. But I know there's sometimes, like you say, you get a lot of these shirts that, you know, they'll wear when they play like a local side for, like, I don't know. Like, I remember when England, in their warm-up to 86, they like played some local side or something. And you just get all these random obscure kits. And sometimes it's literally a training shirt and they've stuck a badge on it for a second or something.
Well, yeah, I mean, I was very keen to involve all of my football kit friends. So you three very kindly looked over a chapter each. Dennis looked over the Irish stuff. Shaky looked over the Wales stuff. And I was very keen to credit all my friends that had helped me with this. And certainly finding that the wonderful Gus, the Portuguese shirt collector, was brilliant. We had several long phone calls going through things. And the Argentina, is it the Racing Club Museum? Rich as well.
Yes, Museo Racing Club, yeah.
The basic criteria was, if it was worn in a match, I wanted to document it. So I know that Dennis found a couple of USA shirts that I think, or one shirt that had been worn in a one-off match in between the two big contracts or something, and I missed that, just didn't see it. Because as I said, the only way to ensure you capture everything is to have photographic evidence of every single game. If you make any assumptions, oh yeah, that would have lasted an extra year, you'll get tripped up, as I've done on occasion here. But yeah, Rich, the basic requirement was, if it was worn in a game, I wanted to have it. I didn't include sponsored shirts, because several unofficial internationals allowed sponsored shirts from, mainly from Denmark and Holland. I didn't want
Sweden
wanna,
and
yeah. Sweden as well. Great one, Chris. Yeah, so I didn't want to go down that route. Didn't want to include the Olympics. But if a team wore it, and Argentina are great, because then you get these stories that they're never allowed to wear the blue and white stripes in these unofficial friendlies. It's almost like the shirt is so precious, it can't be used in those games. So that's when you start to see these odd kind of hybrids and weird variations popping up.
So solid blue and that sort of thing.
Yeah, it was great to see the little stories appearing in that way. But if they wore it in a game, I wanted to have it documented.
I think the other thing you often found with things like that is, and especially like with sort of the South American teams, is that, and I think you mentioned it a minute ago, that you'd have teams where they're sort of, they have a kit that they have, say, from 83 to 87 or something. But then during that period, they'll wear about three other different shirts as well. Yeah. But they'll keep going back to that other shirt. It's just like, the 80s seem to be, there's no consistency at all in certain countries. That it's like, literally you'd have like, well, here's your shirt, and then it's like, oh, but then in this match they wore this one with thin stripes, and then they went back to the other shirt again, and then another match they wore this one. And so you've got this one shirt that's technically lasted like 5 or 6 years, but at the same time, they've worn six other shirts as well. It's just, it's so bizarre.
And Jay used the word arrogance before, and I don't think it's not arrogance on my part, but it's, I guess it could be called complacency, is that you may look at a shirt and think, oh, yeah, well, that would have lasted too, because you, as you say, Rich, you look and you think, oh, well, they wore it then, and they wore it then. But the complacency is, did they wear anything else in between? And quite often they did. Uh-huh. And until you go through, and I think it was the two ones that were the easiest, were Germany, Holland and France and Italy, for example, nearly every single game they've played since the early 70s is on YouTube. So I had to try and document every game. And I have got a spreadsheet that says every game, what France wore, for example. So you know what the kits were. But other teams, it's very hard. The other thing, of course, is variations, mix and match versions. So France would often wear all white away. Officially, the away kits, the away shorts would be blue, I guess. And I've tried to document that. But they might never have worn that combination. They'd have worn all sorts of variants. And until you turn it into an anorak's guide, you can't. It's really hard to include all of those unless you reference it in the text. Yeah.
Well, that comes back nicely on to a point that Rich mentioned earlier on in terms of like the variations. Because the example I was going to give was like with the England, that kit that you love so much, Rich, the England 1982 home kit. The Admiral logo on the shirt at different times has been sort of depicted in blue and red, blue and yellow. And if you drew a different depiction of the kit just to show that difference, you'd have a book just like 15 times thicker than it is. Like there wouldn't be any other room for any other books on the shelf in Waterstones if you had to like do all these.
Yeah.
So you do have to. I mean, obviously, you mentioned the shorts there, John. You know, if there's a sort of significant variation shorts colour, then you do the little sort of circular inset there, and you can just put that in the corner. And I know in previous versions of the True Colours books, you had the little rectangular pop out there if there was a different sponsor on the shirt, which so that helps. But yeah, if you did a different whole kit just for say something as minor as a colour change on the manufacturer's logo, you'd be there all day.
So I've tried to do that. There is little insert sections there, and those two shirts I've included some variations. The other issue is you could write a whole book on that England Admiral shirt. But I've got eight lines. So,
Richard, your next project.
And then you've got to find, you've got to write eight lines on a Denmark away shirt from 1973. And that's when it becomes hard. Because with the time limit there, we couldn't do it couldn't be as varied as I would have liked it. It would have been great to have really done it. But it was designed to be almost like, I guess the theory was with all the True Colours, it's like if you had a load of football cards and you laid them all out, that's what it would be like. So you've got a limited amount of space for each one.
This is the thing. You mentioned that regarding the Admiral logo, and I, as you were saying that, I thought, oh, there's that France shirt from the early 90s where they had the equipment logo and then they changed it to just the Adidas wordmark. And it's like, it's not you that you need it to be in there. It's just like, oh, I'll just go and check whether that's there. And it's fully understandable if it's not there, that change. And I just went to check it there. And I had a good feeling because I checked it before. But and it is there. So the variation is there of the Adidas wordmark as well on the neckline. And it's, or just below the neckline as it is on the updated version of that. But those sorts of things are satisfying where you go, I wonder if that little detail has been included there, and then you go, yeah, it has, that's great. So it's that's where it becomes like a sort of a connoisseur's thing rather than just merely a mass market thing. Obviously the book's got to sell, but it's nice to have those touches in there where you go, no, that bit's for me, that's not for everyone who's excited about just about a World Cup coming up, that bit's for me.
So go on, Rich, you were going to say.
Yeah, what I was going to say was, John, you were saying like sometimes it's. I know what you mean about having to sort of come up with a set amount of words. It's like from my book, which I have just released.
Available in all good bookshops.
Available from Amazon and Conquer Editions and also Waterstones.
Once the coronavirus has ended, you can go out.
I mean, the funny thing is like it's kind of a blessing and a curse, the sort of the word limit, because sometimes if you've got a kit that's really iconic, you want to be able to say a lot about it, and you always, there's always that fear that if you don't say a certain thing, someone's going to read it and go, oh, I can't believe they didn't say that about that shirt. It's like, yeah, but I've only got 80 words or whatever. And it's like, I had the same limit on mine, but the thing I struggled with the most on mine was, obviously because of my collection, there's a lot of really obscure ones. So similar to, you'd have been covering the more obscure shirts. It's like, although I've bought the shirts for mine, it's like there's still no information about them. The only information you've ever seen is like when it was first released, and, you know, sort of like, I don't know, like football shirt culture or something covered it and said, look, here's this shirt that, you know, this Spanish club's releasing about, you know, with some fruit on it or something. And then you think, oh, that's all right, I'll go back to that. And then you look at it and it literally all it says is that, and you're like, ah, crap, what the hell else do I say? And then you sort of, and when you're trying to, you'll find that Wikipedia is not always great when it comes to sort of like third and fourth tier Spanish teams. Because sometimes, and also a lot of them don't exist anymore. But yeah, so trying to find that information, and especially for this project, was like, like you say, I mean, I remember the, I think one of the ones that someone pointed out, which I didn't spot at first, was the Argentina ones where they're wearing grey socks. Mm-hmm. And it's like, and I think something me and you have talked about before, Chris, is like when you're looking back at a lot of these things and so many of the pictures are in black and white, mm-hmm. it's like, for the grey socks, you'd never see that in black and white because you just, well, I'm probably assume it's a shade of blue or something.
Yeah, or dirty socks or something.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So it's just it's the sheer effort that it takes to sort of make sure that you've got it right. And like you said, John, you can't assume. That's the biggest thing. It's like you make that assumption and then someone else out there will know more than you and they'll go, actually.
And that's it. I tried to plunder as much material as I could and make most of my kind of friendships, always crediting them as best I can. So I've tried to credit every source that I've used. And try to get in touch with all these different people, because what you're dealing with as well is a language thing, Rich, as well, is that you're dealing with a whole different languages that you think, well, I don't even know what this is saying. How, you know, see, there's all these other variants that you don't get. If you want to document Doncaster Rovers kit history, yeah, you'd probably struggle at some eras, but you're at least in the ballpark of, you know, you know the language, and you can contact people. With this, you're dealing with people in Uruguay, in Mexico, and it's wonderful that I've got, you know, contacts in Russia now that you could call on, you know. But at the time, it was it's quite sort of scary stuff to delve into that world. Mm.
Are you basically saying you couldn't understand Rich when he was contacting you? Is that what you're basically
saying? Yeah, that's it.
What you say, language problems?
Bad language problem. But and it's it's all these issues that you weren't aware of. And again, you know, you're having to trust the party. And I always try to see, I never relied on someone's documented World Cup history. I always search YouTube, search the image libraries, just to check as best I could. No disrespect to anyone else, to historical kits or to Switch Image or anything else, or, you know, Museum of Jerseys. It's just a point of checking, trying to check again.
You've got to go from the source, haven't you? Yeah.
Yeah. But at one point, because I mean, I did nothing else during this period. My life stopped. I worked almost non-stop on this. I didn't go out at weekends. I just worked on it non-stop. And I think at one point I realised I had, allocating a rough amount of hours per day, I had 15 minutes to write each bit of text for these kids. And of course, it panicked me. I thought, geez, how on earth am I going to do that? And at one point I was looking at, I think, a Russian away kit from the mid-70s. And it was just a blank. What on earth do I write in these 8 lines that's remotely engaging about this shirt? You just, because it's just a crew neck white shirt with, you know, what do you write? So it was there was plenty to get, have a breakdown about, yeah.
And I would say, actually, on that point, I know I appreciate, and I'm sure present company included, and anybody else who owns the book appreciates the fact that what you get in your books is an effort on your part to describe not just what the shirt looks like, but any sort of stories about how the design came about. Because certainly with other books that I've reviewed for Kitbliss, and there are others on the way as well that I'm going to be doing, so, like whether it's a book about kits or badges or whatever, what a lot of people will do in their book with all due respect, is they'll include all the illustrations, which are lovely, but then when it comes to writing the text, they'll then do like a history of the team. Mm. You think, but I haven't bought a book about the history of the team. I wanted to find out more about the badge or the kit or whatever. And this happens time and time again, I find, in different books. And you sort of think and it must be difficult. I mean, I'm speaking, I mean, listen to me, I haven't even bloody written a book before, but in terms of actually making the effort to write the text, I would have thought that what people want to read is something specific about the illustration, if that makes sense, not about the team and the history of how the club was formed and all of that. And you've sort of actually given people what they want, which I think is very commendable. But anyway,
thank you.
Well, I tried to throw that in as a salient point.
I really appreciate that, Chris, because that's something that was important to me, is that so many books, as you say, you end up reading about, if I want to read about the team, I'll buy a history of the team. So I always try to pull it back to the kit itself, and tried my best. And you know, I had a scathing review of my second book that was really bad by some who clearly approaches, you know, most reviewers come with an agenda, and this guy had an agenda. Mm. But I deliberately didn't want to make it, with no disrespect to 442, I didn't want to make it a jokey book. I get a little bit tired sometimes of non-stop jokey, irreverent football reading. Lattish. I wanted to keep it fairly dry, still engaging, but just keep it fairly sober, you know? Mm. That was the definite
absolutely
approach.
Yeah. Don't read mine then, John.
You do brilliantly though, Rich, and your text is fantastic for that reason, that it is, but it's not as, it has got that seriousness side to it as well.
But one thing I was going to say is, and one thing I was going to say actually is, it's very difficult as well when you've got a book about kits. It's finding that balance between giving enough information about the design without sort of in effect just describing what people can see.
Because
it's very easy to fall into the trap and go, and this shirt swapped the collar for this and did this. And it's like, and the people are thinking, I know, I can see it. You know, it's like, it's very hard to sort of, it's very hard to get the line of telling them about the shirt without sort of describing the shirt. That is a really hard thing to do. And that's, I think the True Colours does that perfectly, because it's just like there's no sort of bits where you're reading it going, yeah, I know, I can see that. You've just said it's got a, you know, it's a red shirt with a V-neck. I know, you know.
But you know, Rich, talking about your kind of style, if you're writing about a shirt with a big print of broccoli on the front, it's going to be very hard to approach that in quite a dry way. You have it calls out for a slightly tongue-in-cheek, irreverent approach.
There's the broccoli in the room.
You might say. But the funny thing is, when I first started doing all the writing for mine, sorry to talk about my book for a minute there, available in bookshops. The one thing I did struggle with at first was how to do that style, because I was kind of, I think when I did my own sort of, you know, football attic kit collection 1 and 2, which don't exist anymore, never happened, you know. When I was doing those, it was because it was just kind of doing it for me and for, you know, like about 20 people. It was just like I could do that. Oh, oof, oof.
John is holding up to the camera proof that he has a copy of said books. Yes,
which don't exist. but when I was doing that, it was because it was just for me and you know, a couple of friends and stuff. It was like I could kind of approach it in whatever way I wanted. Mm. So, and that was a lot of the time, it was like, you know, just like kind of me making a comment on the kit. But when I started doing this one, because it was going to be, I was trying to make it more professional. So I was, and I started off, and it's at times I was really getting very dry with it all. And it was like just literally either a history of the team or, you know, something really boring. And the funny thing is, only when I started, when I actually started working with Derek and Gary, and they said, no, actually, it's your personality, put that into it, that's the difference, you know, that's what's selling this book, because it's your collection, you know. Hmm. You don't have to be scathing about things, you know, but put your opinion across and sort of, you know, have it in your voice. And it's quite funny, because there's a couple of entries in the book which were clearly written early on, and there's, and I don't know if people necessarily notice them, but I certainly do, where they're quite dry and nothing sort of, you know.
Before you get into the rhythm of the thing.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's the thing. Once you get into the rhythm, because at first what I was doing was I was like doing, writing the thing and then building the page and then going to the next one and writing the thing and then building the page. And I was just, it was just sort of breaking up the flow. So in the end, I just thought, right, I'm just going to write all the words and then I'll do the pages. And that made it so much easier because then everything flowed. And I was going to say, John, did you find, how did you approach that? Did you just literally have your list of stuff to write about and just sort of, you know, kind of went at it hammer and tongs, so to speak, you know, and just kind of literally banged through every kit? Or were you sort of, I don't know, did you break it up at all?
Well, I mean, the first stage was what I called the broad brushstroke stage. And it was almost like a complete brainstorming of a team. So I'd have all these documents, and I've still got them, if you anyone wanted to see them, of every team, and just put in everything I could find. So just pinned every image, drew all the kits, put dates in, and it was like a big sheet of paper that I just roughly flung everything on. And from that, I then whittled it down to the design. Because I designed the book and typeset it, artworked it, I was able to straight away go into my layouts, if you like, and start to piece the things together. So it was very much that kind of process. And then it goes through the editing and checking and everything else. So, yeah, the broad brushstroke phase was quite fun because that's the one where you've got, you just, you brainstorm everything you can find on that team's kit. And the biggest thing was realizing that you can't make any assumptions. You can't assume that that ended there and that, you know, you just have to try and see every aspect of it.
Yeah. Going back to something that Rich said earlier on, it's almost like he's been reading my notes and he knows what I'm going to say next. But I was going to actually say, if you read international football kits, you can't sort of fail to spot some of these kits. You think, I've never seen that one, but I didn't know that one existed and all that kind of thing. And I was going to pick out a few of my own examples just for people who own the book to sort of pick out. I mean, this is just my sort of personal choice. There's three here I've got on my list. First of all was the Denmark 2008-2009 third kit, which is blue and red, which I thought, what? When did Denmark ever wear blue? It was just like, dang, like this kind of bolt from the blue just hit me. I was like, what? So that was kind of an odd one. The Netherlands 75-77 away kit, which is white with black Adidas trim, which I'd never seen before. I'd seen white with orange in the, you know, 78 World Cup and so on. And again, it's just in that instance, the book comes into its own. You suddenly got proof that this thing existed. And the third one I've got on my list is the Sweden 82-84 away kit, which is sort of white, black and white with black pinstripes, which is very of the era. But I had no idea that Sweden wore it in that colour scheme and that style. It's just, it's lovely to be able to pick up a book and see these things and learn about something that you never knew existed in the first place. So, I mean, Rich has already picked you through. Were there any that you had, Jay, that you sort of thought, oh, I didn't know about that one? But I suppose there'd be loads, really.
Well, plenty. The big thing for me was that's been covered in the Russia kit. So they had so many variations of sort of very similar designs or the same design in lots of different colours, and it just very, very surprising on that. But yeah, that Sweden away, I noticed that one as well. It's just so many great kits that you didn't realise existed, and that's the weird thing where you go, if it's that good a kit, then how do I not hear about it? Because, and it obviously just not necessarily worn in such high-profile games, but you always think that you know all of the great kits, all of the just aesthetically pleasing kits through history you're going to have heard about, and that one was one that I just wasn't aware of. So yeah, plenty of kits like that. What were some others in there? There are a lot that, I mean, you mentioned Denmark. I thought you were going to talk about a different one, which is one that with a weird pattern on it. There's, I can't remember which year it is, sort of around 2000, I think. I'll just get it
98-2000.
98-2000.
The one that
looks like a goalie kit.
Yeah. So that one, I've seen the design before, but I certainly didn't know it was like a Denmark third, or I thought it jogged a memory, but I certainly didn't think that they'd ever had it, and it wasn't ever worn, but I didn't think it would ever be an outfield shirt. It's just so not in keeping with the other two shirts of that time to have such a bizarre design on the front like that. So yeah, lots of gems that I wasn't aware of, and it's great to find them. I don't know whether I think it's sort of a humbling experience where you see all these and go, yeah, I thought my knowledge was good, but then when you actually see all these designs that you weren't aware of, you have to kind of rethink it a little bit. But yeah,
what's funny, Jay, following on...
The positive emotions far outweigh the negative ones.
Following on from that, Jay, things like that that cropped up that I wasn't aware of, and I don't know if you guys were, is when you look at Spain's kits and you realise that from the 60s right through pretty much until the 90s, ignoring the white kits, their away kit was exactly the same as the home, with just a different colour shirt. So they wore the same shorts and socks. Mm. See, I had no idea of that until you actually look at it and think, hang on, they never changed their shorts or socks. It's just the same. It's extraordinary, isn't it, when you think about it?
Yeah. Tell us, if you can, John, about the German kits, because there was a complication about those, wasn't there? There's a bit of a story about those. And some people have asked you, I know down the years, well, why no German kits? So tell us about that.
A few people. Yeah, people ask me almost every day about those. Well, of course, as you said, with the first books, we had to approach everybody for permission. So it meant painstaking, blood-curdling phone calls to every outreach in the world. Can we draw these kits for this book? And you get nations like Mexico that couldn't understand why we were asking. It didn't matter to them. Uruguay, he just said no. That was it. Just hung up. When I learned, do you speak English phonetically in all these different languages? And I found Uruguay and just said, do you speak English? And he went, no, and just dropped the phone. That was it. But with Germany, they said no, or nine. They just said, we can't let you do it. It would infringe our current, trying to remember the wording, our current commercial relationships or something like that. And it was an absolute, because at that point I had 100% track record. Everyone was happy for us to do it. Some nations like Denmark were really enthusiastic. Portugal thought it was fantastic. They were really up for it. So to have that from Germany was an absolute crushing blow. I mean, I won't lie to you. I lost it. I was so upset because I thought, that's it. The book's not going to happen, because the requirement, as Rich said, is that you're always following the publisher's tune. They're putting all this money into it. They are publishing you. You have to do what they want you to do. So if we couldn't have the big teams, there was no book. And I'd done so much work. And my editor, Matt, who's fantastic, a really brilliant guy, we'd done so much work together on it. The idea that it wouldn't happen because of Germany was just, I couldn't comprehend it. It's like it was too big a problem. But Matt sat down and said, okay, is there a way around this? And he did everything. He did everything to try and persuade and change their minds. Fingers crossed, I've got very good relationships with Adidas, and they helped a lot with getting contacts in all the countries. Similar with Nike, Jason McDonald at Nike was superb. And they did everything they could to convince Germany, but they just said, no, we're not doing it. And the Germans, once they've made up their mind, they do not budge. So I can't go into all the ins and outs, but we offered them all sorts of kind of deals and incentives is the word, to try and get them.
I think the thing that disappointed me the most was, because I remember when that was all going on, and like me and Chris and Jay were sort of like, kind of, what about this and what about this? And I think for me, the disappointing thing was that they wouldn't even allow you to put the images of the kits without the badges or the Adidas logos, or even if you remove the three stripes or something, they just wouldn't allow anything. And that kind of was really disappointing, because it's like, come on, it's like, you know, if you take the Federation badge off or do this, it's like, you know, and if Adidas are okay with it, it's like, that's what I think, that's the thing that always can sort of, not confuse me, but I kind of think annoyed me, is the fact that Adidas were okay with it. They're Adidas's designs, and it's like, but they still wouldn't allow it, even if you took the German crest off. It's like, but if you take the German crest off, it's an Adidas shirt. It's like, who owns the copyright to that? So
the biggest
that kind of bugged me.
The biggest thing as well, though, Rich, was, and I don't think a lot of people know this about the book, was that it did originally have a complete set of all Euros and all World Cups in it as well, since 1966. and including all the different variations. It was almost a match-by-match guide. And, of course, when Germany refused permission, that all was scrapped because I didn't want to have the World Cup and then just a blank.
Yeah.
So that was it. So we ended up...
From your point of view, you're probably thinking, like, you've got to have Germany. It's a book about football, international football. You can't not have Germany. I can totally empathise how you must have felt.
Yeah, the 1974 World Cup. There was no World Cup that year.
Won by the Netherlands, I think you were.
Yeah.
And there's a guy, Sean Pankhurst, a friend of mine. He's an ex Reebok and Nike designer. We worked together and he helped me with illustrations. So we were both of us churning out these World Cup and Euros illustrations. Nothing, can't do anything with him. So,
wow.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. It is a strange one, especially with Germany, because it's always Adidas, even if it's like a Rima or something. It's like still basically Adidas, isn't it? It's still tied in with the Adidas deal. So it's like, it just seems so odd that they do that. And it's kind of to your credit, you've got that is the worst section of the book, and like it's a fantastic book, but that is the worst section because it's not uniform anymore. You can't have the same pose of a football. If you're going to put photographs in there instead of the kits, you can't have the same pose for every kit. So the consistency goes on that section. It had to be included, and it had to be included that way because they wouldn't allow you to render the kits, but. It doesn't matter. It doesn't take away from... Well, the book would be better if it had Germany in all illustrated, but it's not a fatal thing or anything like that. It doesn't ruin the book, but it is the worst section of it. And it's just... Like, your approach has been very grown up about it, but you could... because I'm into sort of shithousery... there is like the temptation to just put redacted on them. So to have a Germany section just redacted all the way through and just an explanation. Uh-huh. That person, like as you would on, like when you empty seat someone where they don't come to a TV like debate or something like that. So like they did with Boris Johnson and things before the election, just say, well, this person declined to be involved. So let's just shame them. And in terms of like what it is now, have you like sent them a copy of the book? That would, again, because I... I'm unprofessional and I am my own worst enemy. My immediate thing would have been to send them a copy of the book and say, was that a good decision? Look at all these federations that have allowed me to include their kits and look at your section in here, how bad it looks and how bad you look as a consequence of that.
And wipe your ass on it as well.
I think my main aim with anything is to produce something that gives value to people, that if people spend their 20 quid on it, they get value from it. I don't want to put anything out that's not as good as I can make it. That's always my main call. Mm. With Germany, I had to respect their decision. And it comes back down to the legalities of drawing again. You can put a photograph of the shirt, but you can't draw the shirt.
Mm.
It makes no sense, does it really? But that's how it is. But yeah, but I think... Mm. I think there will be communication with them again, Jay. And should a reprint come out for the next major tournament, maybe things will change. And it's certainly, I'm always keen to build those bridges and show that respect to them and their decision. But it is, you know, it's funny, I don't often think about it, to be honest, but talking with you guys today and looking at the book, I do feel my heart drop a bit when I look at that bit and think, do you know what? Because the Germany kits as well are fantastic. They're some of the best kits in international football. Mm. To not have them represented in a way that I would be really delighted with is a bit of a choker. But actually, there's also...
I was going to say, John. Yeah, go on.
Just to say very, very briefly, there was another country as well who it was literally their approval came through, I think, the day before we were due to go to press. So there is another country that I have... a photography section like this that we had to have geared up. So we had to buy loads of images and artwork, all these pages, so we had two sets for this country. And if they said yes, we'd go with that one. If they said no, we'd go with that one.
I was just going to say, were you not even allowed to write in the book that they'd refused? Because I think I've always found that strange that in the section, it's just literally you have this section and then for no reason you've got photos. But I didn't know if that was because you weren't even allowed to say the German Federation refused. Because it's Because that certainly would have answered a lot of people's questions. Because, like I say, occasionally there's a couple of reviews on Amazon which sort of go, "Oh yeah," and then the German section's crap. It's not. It's like, and it's just frustrating that obviously having, you know, like I say, with the three of us, we were there when it was all happening and sort of, you know, felt your pain when it was going on. And that always kind of grated with me that you couldn't even put that in the book to say, "Look, I know this section is not what the rest of it is, but this is why." And I didn't know if that was just whether that was you weren't allowed to, or if that was just the publisher's choice not to sort of kind of say, let's not just, you know, make any sort of enemies here or whatever. I don't know.
Do you know if
what was the decision on that one?
Answering honestly, I can't remember. But you're absolutely right. I'm looking at it now. I'm thinking that would have been a really good way to have done it. I think maybe a decision was taken, not by me, that it probably wasn't, there was no need to do that, that we just had to treat it, because otherwise it's almost saying on publication, this part of the book isn't as good as the rest. And I think that was maybe the decision was made not to do that. Matt and the Bloomsbury team are so meticulous with stuff like that, that they'd be thinking that through very carefully. But yeah, I mean, look at that now, that might have been a way to have gone around that and sort of say, unfortunately, we've had to take a different approach to these illustrations and included photography instead. Yeah, good point.
On the subject of photography, it has to be said that there's actually a great use of photography, as well as the German kits. The fact that you have these lovely kind of buffers, as I kind of think of them, to separate the different sections of the different countries in the book, sort of fantastic from the 1966 World Cup onwards. I think that's a really nice touch, actually, just to sort of use that, because it with the greatest of respect, you know, if you've got a book that's quite text heavy, even with the number of illustrations that you've done, if you were reading it page after page after page, it can be quite hard going. But you've sort of got these little buffer zones in the middle where you go, oh look, there's a picture of England and France in the 1966 World Cup or whatever, and it's nice that they're in there, actually. So I commend you for your use of photography in the book.
Well, thank you, Chris. I mean, that's one of those fortuitous accidents, because I think it's okay to say that every time there's photography, that's what would have been a World Cup or a Euros page. So we had to fill the pages, because basically paper had been ordered and the book was set to be X amount of pages. And all of a sudden we couldn't put in these tournaments. But actually it worked really well. Both Matt and I, Matt especially, my editor, was the one who really made the effort with the photography. And you know, I thought he did brilliantly in choosing them. We both worked on it, but it does need that breathing space. So I'm really pleased we went for that in the end. Design is often fortuitous mistakes. You think, oh, okay, actually that's worked out for the best. And I think the photography in here is, and the way we've gone for a very close crop is wonderful.
Yeah. I was just going to sort of say, I remember there was a comment you made around the time of the launch of the book. You said that the new book has got twice the content of your previous books, but you did the whole thing in about half the time.
Yeah.
I was sort of curious as to know whether there was a particular change in the way of working on the book and the preparation that allowed that to happen, because that doesn't seem possible to me that you could do that, have twice as much in half the time.
Well, I think there's several reasons there. One is, once you've illustrated kits, you do tend to, you have a version that you can just recolour. So say, for example, you look at that and think, I know that kit, who else wore that? And you think, oh yeah, it's that one, take that, recolour it. So you've saved time that way around.
Yeah.
There were no sponsorships to get approval from, so that wiped out a whole load of time. And also just that experience of, you got a better understanding of the kit world, I guess. So the research in terms of tournaments and players and who wore what when, that was hard, because I haven't always got that knowledge, I guess. But it literally was. When I said that, there was no exaggeration. It is double the content in half the time. It was and of course, when a deadline's looming, you cannot miss that deadline. For the World Cup, it had to come out. So there's no option, you just drop everything. So I didn't socialise, I didn't go out with my family, I just worked on it all the time.
Yes, And that's what makes you a better man on these things than me. I think, John, I'd be sort of saying, well, I think I'm going to have tonight off. I've been working solidly for the last 45 minutes. I think I'm going to have a cup of tea. Hence why I've never produced a book. In terms of actually illustrating the shirts and so on, is there a sort of perfect shirt that you think you can illustrate? I mean, is it in your mind a perfect shirt to illustrate something that's simple, or do you appreciate the challenge of doing a shirt that's more complicated in the detail? What's your ideal one? You think, oh, great, I love doing kits like this one or shirts like this one.
I think one thing I love is seeing shirts that are almost the same as another one but different. And going back to Russia again, Russia really kind of give a lot. Their first set of Nike shirts were the same as Arsenal's ones from a couple of years earlier, and I love doing those. Mm-hmm. And also things like doing them in long sleeved. So for those shirts, they only ever wore long sleeve versions, so I had to illustrate them as long sleeved. Little things like that that give me a little bit of a buzz, that you think, yeah, oh, okay, I'm not going to do that short sleeve because I never wore it. And it's that little attention to detail. When you look at some of them, for example, the Denmark Hummel shirts at one period, and their shadow prints were so complicated, my heart sank. Because when you know, I've got a big chart on my wall that said how long I had to do each one. And I thought, oh God, I've got to illustrate this. And that was quite a ball ache, I have to say, because you then think, I've got to get this reasonably correct, but it's such a deep, and often they don't even shine out of the pages, you know, because it's so subtle. You think, I spent so long doing that.
That sort of touches on another question I was going to ask about sort of illustrating the kit. I was going to basically ask, how difficult did you find it getting the exact colour for certain shirts? Because it's a real kind of, I suppose, the community that we find ourselves in, there are a lot of people who are absolutely obsessed about football kit design and consider themselves maybe to be experts and connoisseurs on a particular team's kit that's, you know, and history of football kit design and all that. And so therefore getting the colour of certain shirts right, the tone of colour, is the sort of thing that can irritate a lot of people if you get it wrong. Did you ever felt the sort of pressure of having to get it spot on, and what was your whole sort of approach to getting the colour right?
Not at all. And what I did with my first books was I realised that unless you saw the shirt in the flesh, you can't be sure exactly what colour it is. And especially blues. Anyone that's in design will know that blue is the hardest colour. It's the less stable colour. Blue ink takes longer to dry than any other colour ink, for example. So when you see photography of blue, it's the colour that varies the most. So I had to accept at some point, unless the colour was radically different, and I'm thinking England's away shirt when they went to a very dark red in the 94, that was clearly very different. But any other subtle variations I had to ignore, because you cannot be sure exactly what colour, what shade of colour it was. So that's one of those things. When you're doing a book of this size, and Rich will know this as well, you have to surrender to mistakes, because there will be mistakes. You have to do that. There's certain things you have to surrender to, and one of them was those subtle variants in colour. You just have to let that go. So unless it was very, very different, Brazil's a great example. The slight variations in the yellow. There's a couple there that I can see, but most of the time you just have to surrender to that.
Make allowances for it and so on.
And
just a sort of general open question really for anybody to answer, sort of two questions really. One of them is, which country in the book do you think has got the most interesting kit history now that you've had a chance to see it? And as a sort of second question, which country not in the book would you like to have seen? Not suggesting that John made a mistake by not including it, but which country would you like to see? Would you have liked to have seen in the book that isn't there? You can answer either of those questions in any order, or both, or neither. Or
I'd like to have seen the Germany kits. I don't know. That's a really good question. Actually, I'm just going to have a quick flick through and see.
Because I guess all the main countries are sort of there, obviously, as John sort of mentioned earlier on, because that's what helps to sort of sell the book. And if you're thinking of sort of countries that aren't in, there's not many, really. I mean, I suppose you've got, the, you know, Norway and Finland, I suppose, from Scandinavia, and then you've got some of the Eastern European countries. And so it's kind of, I think you've sort of got all the right ones in there, really, in terms of sort of first choice.
Romania would have been good. I like that history.
That's a good shout.
And they do some weird things in terms of getting rid of a kit, then wearing one kit, and then going back to the first kit again, and just the very slight variations. There is a Museum of Jerseys piece on, I don't know how far back it goes, but that would have been a great one. Argentina is probably the one for me that was most satisfying and most eye-opening. So that the idea of so many non-striped kits being worn in friendlies. So I was obviously aware of the Linfield game where they wore that Netherlands type design, the geometric isometric thing. But I didn't know that was like a regular thing, that they would wear non-striped shirts when they were playing against club sides. So and that playing against club sides was such a big part of like their friendly fixture list and that kind of thing as well. So Argentina was the most exciting for me. Russia as well was great. Just too many to choose from. They're just, all of it was beyond what I even thought it was going to be. Because I thought it would be a nice way of keeping everything, a lot of knowledge together for reference and that kind of thing, so I can quickly go to that and check things. And yes, it is that as well, but the amount, I mean, you still will skim through it, but then if you take a longer look at a section, then you'll notice things that you've missed the time before, and especially obviously if you then read into it as well, if you're going to read all the text as well, you're going to learn extra things there as well, reasons for why particular kits were worn. So yeah, just it's great.
For me, I would say Mexico was one of my favourite sections, because they have some really strange kits, and they have quite a good variation of sort of kit design. And the funny thing is, early on, they're all quite sort of plain and stuff, and then they have some absolutely strange designs. Like, again, Russia was another good section. For me, Argentina, obviously, I kind of knew most of those anyway, so it wasn't much of a surprise. I tell you what I would like to see is Colombia. They've got an interesting kit history, because they've changed colours quite a lot of times. I mean, the one thing is that people always think, when you see Italia 90 and they've got the red kit and the yellow kit, and everyone always goes, oh, the yellow kit, that's the home kit. But it wasn't. It was their away kit at the time. And they used to wear orange. They've got a really, really interesting kit history up until probably about sort of mid to late 90s, where they sort of stabilised with orange as the home colour. Mm. So prior to that, they're quite fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah. I noticed that some of these pages were stuck together. I don't know how that happened.
Okay.
literally, as I was going through it, there's something that's... And so... Also, the USA, you mentioned the
USA. Can you put that up as your review on Amazon? Just that, just literally, some of the pages are stuck together. 5 stars. Yeah. Actually, no, 4 stars, then knock a point off because the Germany pages just aren't up to it.
Maybe I could use that for that then. And then that could stay stuck together and that bit's fine. Don't damage the rest of the book. Right, so... The USA section. So you mentioned that was maybe like a concession to the marketing side, that USA had to be kept in there. Not traditionally a great force in football, but that is actually one of my favourite sections. Some of the kits they've got in there are wonderful. So it would have been a shame if they hadn't made it in, especially now that it has made it in. I've gone through it and seen how great a lot of the kits were, and again, so many kits that I weren't aware of, and the weird variations. So that's a really good one. Something I hadn't thought of as well. So France is obviously a big section for me, and I love that for all the reasons that we've gone through before regarding the other sections. But also we spoke about inspirational kits last week, and it's just that reminds you that in 1998 France wore basically the same design that they wore in 1984. And if you want to talk about an inspirational kit, they'd hosted it in 84, they'd won it in 84, so hosting the Euros, and then in 98 they were hosting the World Cup, they decided to go with a very similar kit to what they wore in 84, and they won it again. So that's like one of the greatest examples of going for an inspirational kit there. That I don't think we covered in any great detail when we did that, but yeah. So the France section again is a great section for me.
Actually, I was going to say the France section is a really interesting one because they, again, similar to Mexico, have had quite an interesting range of designs up until obviously 1988, where they just then kept using the same fucking template over and over again, which I might have mentioned before.
But what's good about French stuff is that it's almost their flagship for Adidas, because it's like every major Adidas design trend France wear, and Spain as well. Mm-hmm. So it's almost a history of Adidas templates, because France have always got them, but beautifully done, and the lovely tricolour trim, the way they get the red in there as well. So it is, I mean, I really love the French kits for that version as well, Rich, yeah.
Yeah, I totally agree with what's been said in terms of like Mexico being a good kit history section, France. I was going to say USA as well, and then I realised how conceited that would sound, given the fact that I helped to do some of the research on the USA section. But
yeah.
But as you said, Rich, there's so many great designs that they've had down the years in their history. I suppose one has to ask the inevitable question, John, is that are there any plans for a fourth book? And if so, what sort of subjects interest you? If we just talk hypothetically for the time being, at least, are there any particular subjects you'd like to sort of cover? And should that happen?
I think there will be a fourth book, and it will be something slightly different. But I can't say too much more about it at the moment. How that will come off. If I had my way, and I haven't shared these with you, I might share them with you. I don't know if I want to say it, because then someone else might run away with the idea. But I still like the idea of a massive book that's got everything in it. That's just got everything. That's what I'd like to do.
Yeah, absolutely.
And get paid a way to earn enough money from doing it that I didn't have to work. Just do that.
Yeah,
that would be the trick. That's what I'd like. Yeah, but
when you mentioned that earlier. I was thinking, well, I'd buy that. I don't know why that would not be marketable, the huge book. But that's definitely...
But you know what, Joe, that's the thing that actually happens, and it's one of those things in the modern world, I think, with social media, is that you get one person says, oh, yeah, I'd buy that, or I'd buy a book that had Scunthorpe kits in it, and you think, oh, my God, I've got to do it, because the public are calling for it, and then you realise it's actually one person, and you're trying to shift 15,000 books or whatever. It's just... You know, it's just that one person.
I like to do that. I like to just go on random social media posts and just go, yeah, I'd buy that, even though I'd never intend to buy it. Just to set people up on a journey.
2.5-year project.
Yeah.
That's right.
Actually, I mean, if you did do that, that would be ace if you did that. It would be like you could potentially call it like the sort of True Colours Bible, and it'd be like the definitive collection. You know, but obviously you'd have to sort the Germany bit out, John. Come on.
But also,
put some effort into that.
But also, you know, I'd love it to be really collaborative. That's what I'm really into, is working with other people. And that's why I try to bring in all my sort of kit friends as much as possible to each con, because I felt, without sounding corny, that I want to give something back, that they're part of this as well. Without obviously having any money from it, but that's the thing.
I've got a question. I've got a question, and this is for Jay and Chris, and that is, when you got the book, how soon was it that you went to look for your name in the acknowledgement section?
Not soon. I think I not quickly for myself. I just went through the book, but then I think I took it somewhere. Oh, I had it in my bag, and I. Like, went to lunch with people, and I said, oh, yeah, I got this new book this week. It's brilliant and stuff. And then I said, oh, I think my name's in it. And then I had it in my bag, and I reached in, got it out, and then showed people, oh, look, my name's in here, and showed it to people. So probably worse. It was like, it wasn't like I felt a sense of pride at being in it, but I used it in order to impress people. So that's probably an even worse way of dealing with it.
But you know your name's
still friends with those people.
The sections that you helped with, you know your names at the beginning section as well, don't you? You've seen them.
Yeah, I do. Well, the funny thing is, I didn't spot that for months. Yeah. Oh, okay. I didn't see that at all. Well, that's mainly because I didn't particularly read the intro, because obviously it's the Argentina section, so I know that, and obviously I was just too busy looking at the kits, you know, and those pages and stuff together. But yeah, it was like literally months later, I was like, oh, it says special thanks to me. I was like, oh, okay, thank you, John.
Well, I was going to say, doing the classic sort of politician's thing of answering a question by asking another question, but I was going to sort of say, how many people that bought the book did the kind of classic thing of just going through, sort of skimming through, like, just literally couldn't absorb enough visual information quickly enough because there was so much colour on the pages and interest that you just kind of go, oh, and you just flick through, like, just to get that initial hit, like mainlining football kit illustrations into your system. And then afterwards you go, oh, breathe, and then you go back and start savouring the detail. And that's kind of what I did, I think, before I even started looking for my name, because it just seemed like an absolute avalanche of colour and form. It was just amazing. It's like the old days when you used to collect football stickers. I'd just sort of stick them all in. Like, if I had loads of opened packets, I'd stick all the stickers in, but not really look at who was on the sticker afterwards. And then you go back and go, I've got Mark Wright of England. And it was almost like the main thing was to get the stickers in the book rather than to actually look at who. Yeah, that's kind of a mangled metaphor, but I think I know what I'm talking about. Anyway.
But, you know, it's been really great today to look through these pages again, because I think I don't look at it. And this has really kind of lifted me today, hearing you say all these wonderful things and looking at the book again. It's really, yeah, given me a big boost. So thank you.
Well, I've got a question for you, John.
Yeah.
Sorry, can I just... having, obviously, and again, I hate to see sort of go on out of my book.
God, here he goes.
Available at all good bookshops and concreteditions.co.uk. No, I was going to say, by the time that it came out, I mean, don't tell Derek and Gary this, they won't listen to this. I was sick of the damn thing. Because it's so familiar. Because you've seen it, like, every day for, like, months.
Yeah.
And you know it intimately. You know every inch of each page. So by the time you get it, I mean, I think I remember getting very excited when I got an ISBN number. That was when it first felt like, wow, this is actually like a proper book. But the funny thing is, when the books arrived, it was like, it's so familiar that you sort of pick it up and it's like, there's that initial thing of, my God, this is like my book. But then it's like very quickly sort of, but it's like, there's nothing for me in there because I know it all. It's like, did you ever get that, John, when you, and for any of them, when you first got them, you were like, here's a book. Yeah, great. I know it all.
The first book, the first True Colours, was totally different because I think that had been my dream, my ambition, since I was a little boy, since I first got into football and got that Observer book of football that Chris mentioned earlier. So that was slightly different. I'd never forget that day when I first saw the book. It's just the most wonderful experience, that ambition come true. But certainly... And even when I'm as a designer, I don't often look at anything I've done because all you see are what you could have done better. Mm-hmm. And certainly here, there's plenty that I think, oh, I could have done that better. I've made a mistake there. Oh, Christ, that's a howler. Uh-huh. That's a massive mistake. You just have to let it go. But so that's why I don't often look at it, Rich, if I'm honest. But I'm looking at it now and I'm pleasantly surprised when I look at it again. So,
Just on future books, what's happening with the snooker waistcoat?
because I am definitely
buying it. Well, I'm all systems go because one person said they'd buy it, Jay. So yeah, I'm definitely doing it.
I think that was me.
Well, I hope you sort of feel proud of your achievements, John. And given the fact that yes, you might sort of spot one or two mistakes, I think you're kind of above the line of sort of guilt because of the fact that no one else has really bothered to do a kit book like this. So I think you're kind of exonerated from any sort of blame, I think. You know, the fact that you've spent so much time doing it and put together such a fantastic book. I'm sure everyone that owns a copy of it loves it for all the colour and detail that you incorporated into it. So, I mean, I said it at the time, but basically congratulations on doing such a fantastic book, because I'm sure I speak for all of us when I sort of say how amazing it is.
Bless you. Thank you, Chris.
And listeners that still want to buy the book, you can still pick it up from amazon.co.uk for $14.99. And needless to say, needless to say, it's widely available from all good bookshops and online. At least that's the case in non-coronavirus circumstances, at least. Anyway,
but also, I just want to say a big thank you to you three for supporting me all the way through it. I know I've thanked you before, but all of you, you three especially, have been so supportive and given me that backing. So I'm really, really grateful for that.
To be honest, John, it was a privilege to be involved. Really, absolutely, I mean that very sincerely. It was like, because I remember, like I say, when I saw the first one and just thinking what an amazing book that was when the first one came out. To think that, like, sort of X number of years later, I'd actually be involved in helping create one of them. It was just like, wow, that was like a big thing for me. So yeah, it was a privilege to be involved.
I've just noticed something. It's not a mistake. Because of the way the fonts are used, you can actually, the first three letters of Illustrated look like three in Roman numerals, so you can read it as True Colours 3 like that as well.
Hey.
Illuminati confirmed.
I like a
career in publishing.
Brilliant.
All right, well, there's not much kit news to report at the present time. It's mostly sort of leaks and concept kits that are doing the rounds at present. But if it's kit news you're after, just to say that the South African national team are preparing to launch their new Le Coq Sportif kit online because of the coronavirus outbreak. They were with Nike until the end of March, and they've now switched to Le Coq Sportif. Don't see much of Le Coq Sportif these days, apart from at sort of Saint-Étienne and Fiorentina, so I'm quite looking forward to seeing what they come up with for South Africa.
Yeah, that's one of those things that initially I'm thinking, oh, that sounds exciting. And then I think, but hang on, didn't Le Coq Sportif do, was it Senegal shirts they did for a while? They did, I think they did a few African teams, and they were generally a bit crappy. So
Cameroon ones.
Yeah, they could be a bit
Cameroon ones are good.
Oh, is that Le Coq Sportif as well?
Yeah, the new ones, the latest ones. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's what I mean. That since they sort of had a bit of a rebirth with St. Etienne and Fiorentina recently, they seem to have hit a nice vein of form, but we'll see.
Yeah. And elsewhere in Scotland, Ayr United have signed a new multi-year deal with Hummel, the first time that those two parties have worked together. The Scottish club will get one bespoke kit every year from Scandinavian suppliers and will continue to be sponsored by Bitcoin SV. How about that for you? Yes. But that's about all the news for this episode, really. So I think on that note, all that's left is to draw matters to a close. So let me give my grateful thanks to my guest today, John Devlin, the subject of our podcast. Thank you very much indeed, John.
No, thank you guys today. It's been a wonderful morning. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you, and thank you to Rich.
Thank you. Pleasure as always.
Thank you, sir. And thanks once again to Jay. Thank you, Jay.
Thank you, thank you, thank you for having me on. Thanks.
You're welcome, and thank you, listeners. Join us again soon for another edition of the Kiplist podcast. But for now, from the four of us, it's goodbye to you all. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You can contact Kiplist via the website at kiplist.co.nz, at facebook.com/kiplistonline, or at twitter.com/kiplistnz. And don't forget, if you want to listen to the very latest Kiplist podcast as soon as they're available, please visit patreon.com/kiplist. The Kiplist podcast was produced and presented by me, Chris Oakley. The associate producers were Terry DeFellin, Trim Hogner, Dennis Hurley, Les Motherby, Rich Nelson, Neil Rawlings, Jonathan Smith, Keng Lai Tan, and Rick Keepers Heath. And the senior associate producers were Jay from DesignFootball.com, Rich Johnson, Chris Nee, and Nick Sint.